evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight I'll be speaking with Lala Brooks. She was about 12 and a half when she started singing with the Crystals, and some of what she did sing lead on to Do Ron Ron, along with Then He Kissed Me, became their biggest hits. Brooks will be performing in the region soon, and we'll have more on that a bit later in the program. Opening up the program, we have Emmanuel Rogers with a book that should be a thriller, but it comes from the world of nonfiction. And a warning, some of the material in this first interview may be disturbing.
Joining us today is author Mark Bowden. Mark has written many books, including Killing Pablo, Finders Keepers, Guest of the Ayatollah, and Black Hawk Down. Mark is here to speak with us about his new book, The Last Stone. Thank you for joining us today, Mark.
You're welcome, Emmanuel.
Mark, as we spoke a little bit earlier here, I told you this has been a very good book, but a very hard read because of the subject matter. Now, you have written 13 books that included Killing Pablo and Black Hawk Down. Your new book, The Last Stone, began in 1975. How did you become involved in what was at that time thought to be a kidnapping of two young girls, Kate and Sheila Lyons?
Well, I was a young reporter for the Baltimore News American. I was just 23 years old, and I was assigned to go cover this story. And for several weeks, it was really the big story in the Baltimore, Washington, Virginia area. And, you know, I got to know the family and the detectives searching desperately to find some trace of these two vanished little girls. And nothing ever came of it. No one ever found what had happened to them. It remained a mystery that, frankly, kind of haunted me ever since.
No, there was no kidnapping note or anything like that? No demand for ransom?
Nothing. There were a couple of cruel hoaxers who tried to extort money from the family by claiming to have the girls. None of that unfolded, but nothing that was real, and then nothing that led the police to any kind of resolution or understanding.
Wow. Now, before we go on a little bit more about what happened there, will you tell us about the family that was devastated by this tragedy, the Lyons family? What were they like?
Sure. Well, John and Mary Lyon were in their 30s. They had four children, their two daughters and two sons. John was a prominent radio personality in Washington, well-known. He and his wife, Mary, had performed in folk bands. They were musicians and performers. They were cool. They were really fun, interesting people. And it just seemed totally out of the blue that this terrible thing had happened.
For the sake of our audience and to help them understand what we're doing here, what was the community like that the Lyons were a part of at that time? And how did this affect them?
You know, the Lyon family, like many in the 1960s and 70s, were living in what were essentially white suburbs. A lot of white people were fleeing the inner cities, trying to get away, frankly, from, you know, their fears of African Americans and their fears of crime.
Right.
And so they viewed their suburban communities as the safest places in the world. And frankly, I grew up in a neighborhood like this where my mother would send my brothers and sisters and I out after breakfast and say, don't come back until lunchtime. There was no concern about sending your children out just to sort of roam the community. And this crime, the disappearance of these two little girls, had such a profound impact on the sense of security and safety that many people had in their communities.
Now, this is really, you know, telling for our country, because I grew up in a neighborhood like you're describing, only it was more of an African-American neighborhood, well, though mixed. And we didn't come in until the streetlights came on, and then we're allowed to play a little bit after that if we stayed close by the house. So this is really amazing.
Yeah, it is. And you can feel how a tragedy like this just changes parents' whole attitude toward what you describe.
Yes. I can see the fear and, you know, just, wow, is it my neighbor? Was it somebody I know? We just don't have a clue. So that's really scary. Now, Mark, this horrific crime also affected the police working this case in ways that is hard for those who are not reporting. It's hard for us to understand this. Will you share with our audience your perception at that time of how police officers dealt with this crime?
Well, my memory is that they were frantic because they, first of all, were desperate to try to find these girls for their parents' sake, and also overwhelmed because the publicity that this event received, again in the Washington and Baltimore and Virginia area, produced a flood of leads and tips, all of which had to be followed up on.
Right.
And so there was more work than they could handle. And part of the problem with that is that the things that, in retrospect, were important or weren't meaningful kind of got lost in the flood.
Yes, yes, and I read about that, and we'll get to that too. But for now, Mark, will you take just a moment to share with our audience where they can find out more information about your book, The Last Stone, and other works you have done?
I think the easiest way is just to go to Amazon online or Barnes & Noble. You'll find descriptions of all my books and of me, and it's easy to order the book there if you want. The book is also available at bookstores all over the country.
Thank you for that. Now, as I said, this is a hard subject because of the subject matter and children being involved. Will you talk with us about what happened to Kate and Sheila Lyons as far as we know now?
Sure. And, you know, I should add here, Emmanuel, that mm-hmm. I probably would never have come back to write about this story if it weren't for the extraordinary way that the detectives in this case were able to solve it. And ultimately, it appears as though Lloyd Welsh, at age 18, perhaps with help from members of this bizarre family that he came from, kidnapped these girls from the mall, drugged them, raped them, kept them prisoner for a period of a week or so, and ultimately killed them and dismembered them and burned their bodies in a bonfire in Western Virginia.
Yeah, that is very difficult to just digest there. Now, as far as Mr. Welsh goes, who was this person that perpetrated this crime, and how was he initially involved in the case?
He was 18 years old at the time, and he was kind of a cast-off from this strange family that had relocated to Hyattsville, Maryland, a suburb of Washington, from the hills of Western Virginia. And they brought with them this kind of insular culture of kind of an outlaw attitude toward authority and mainstream society, but also a really twisted family culture of sexual predation. So it was this very aberrant kind of world that Lloyd Welsh emerged from. And he was also an outcast from this family. So he was living on the street. He was a much more hardened figure than most 18-year-old kids.
What? You know, this is something that I really didn't give much thought to. I read the book and I saw how he was protected and other things. But to think about him being an outcast from a family of outcasts, that's kind of, it's hard to describe for me.
Yeah. Well, it gave me some insight, Emmanuel, into one of the big questions that I always had about this story is that who would do such a thing, you know, and what would their motivation be? And here you see in Lloyd Welsh someone who was taking lots of drugs, who came from this horrible background, who, as I said, was a really sort of hard case living on the streets. He describes himself as having been a very angry person at that age. And so you can almost understand someone like him acting out by stealing these two little girls from a world that he could never hope to enter,
right,
and abusing them in this terrible way.
Mark, I have heard that among criminals, especially arsonists, they often go back to the scenes of their crimes to get some type of perverted satisfaction. Why did Lloyd Welsh initially even speak to the police a week after this crime, knowing that he had been the one that they were looking for, though the police did not know this at the time?
Yeah, if there was some motivation to inject himself into the story. But I think the larger motivation was that he was afraid that the police were going to connect him to this case, and knowing that he was guilty, he went to them to try to mislead them, to tell them a story that would send them off in another direction. And in fact, he did name this other person as the most likely suspect to try to mislead the police.
Now, I saw that, but now my read was just a little bit different, because Lloyd Welsh, being a consummate liar, when he spoke to the detectives, it seemed to me like he was really just going back to the scene of that crime and thinking he was smarter than the police. Do you find that he did think he was smarter?
I think that's true. I think there's an element of that to it. I know that he has claimed that his motivation was to, you know, throw them off the trail. But, you know, it is really odd. You would think that there was such a risk involved. in showing up, knowing that you are the person that they're all looking for. There has to be some thrill gained by just showing up and figuring that you can outsmart them and they'll never get on to you.
Yeah. As he was an outcast in among his own family, and his family were doing the very same things that they taught him to do, molesting and, you know, assaulting people, why did they protect him so long?
Well, a couple of reasons. I think, first of all, you know, none of the kinds of activities that I described that happened in that family were ever reported to the police. There was a culture of protecting the family, which was paramount. And then, secondly, I mean, I think when, and this is sad to say, but that when Lloyd shows up with these two little girls drugged, that his father or his uncle saw an opportunity to take advantage of them themselves. They had an appetite for something like this, and then they certainly could never have turned those girls loose after what they did. They killed them and disposed of their bodies.
I really want the audience to understand this. He brought them not to a secret place where no one knew, but he brought them to a place where his family actually saw these girls and abused them themselves.
Apparently that's the case. He brought them back almost without question to his father's house, where his father had remarried and had children of his own. The basement room was separate from the rest of the house, and that's where they hid these girls.
How long was this case unsolved? When did they pick it back up?
It was in 2013, which is almost 40 years, 38 years after Lloyd went to the police with his story and after the girls disappeared, that one of the cold case detectives found this statement that Lloyd had made in 1975. And because the detective was looking at a completely different suspect, mm-hmm. who walked with a limp and saw that Lloyd had described the person he saw take the girls as walking with a limp, he set out looking for Lloyd Welsh as a witness, hoping that he would be able to identify the man that the detective thought had actually done it.
When the detective went looking for Lloyd Welsh, where did they find him?
They found him in prison in Delaware, serving a sentence for child molestation.
This is just an amazing story. It is just a really amazing story. So let me go back just for a moment. When Lloyd Welsh met with the detectives at the mall, he met them at the mall he kidnapped the girls from. Is that correct?
That's right.
He gave them the description of the other guy. He also lied to them about everything about him, you know, whether he was married, he had graduated, and all of these things. Why weren't these things checked at the time?
They weren't, because they just dismissed him as a knucklehead who was trying to draw attention to himself or who was trying to get some of the reward money that was being offered. So they didn't take him seriously, and they never thought, I mean, who would be so foolish to come to the police himself if they had done this themselves? So those connections were never made.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing right there. But I do understand the times and all, and thinking they had someone being helpful. Now, they found him in a Delaware prison. What happened after that?
Well, they went to see him, hoping that he would be able to corroborate the man who they suspected of kidnapping the Lyons sisters. But as soon as they met Lloyd in the prison, he told them a completely different story than the one he had told in 1975.
Right.
And the more they talked to him and the more he lied, the more they began to suspect that he was involved in some way. Otherwise, why would he be working so hard to mislead them?
Right. Okay, so they found the guy. What is the final disposition, as far as we know, for Lloyd Welsh for this crime?
Well, Lloyd has pleaded guilty to kidnapping and killing these girls, and he'll be spending the rest of his life in prison. The detectives who worked on the case each have different theories about exactly what happened. One of them believes Lloyd did this mostly by himself. The others don't believe that he could have, and they believe other members of his family or even other people in the community who were child molesters might have helped him with this.
Mark, your book, The Last Stone, it is not a work of fiction for our audience. This is a very good read. It is also heartbreaking in a lot of ways, but there is justice. And we want to thank you for sharing this with us.
You're welcome. My pleasure. I'm grateful to have been invited.
Yeah, you are more than welcome. And as a veteran myself, I really appreciate your work on Black Hawk Down and showing some things that most people never get to see that our soldiers go through. Thank you again.
Well, thank you, and you're welcome.
You're welcome also.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Mark Bowden. Find The Last Stone and other works by Bowden at bookstores and online retailers. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org.
There's a story I want you to know about my baby, how I love him so.
Lala Brooks. If you don't know the name, you'd know the group for which she sang, The Crystals. And if you think you don't know The Crystals, you would know a couple of their biggest hits, songs on which Lala sang lead. Think And Then He Kissed Me, also To Do Ron Ron, brought to the foreground once again by Sean Cassidy in 1977. But even if you know the songs, you may not have known her real name, not Lala. We know you as Lala, and I even heard a story recently involving you and your dad, and you told the story with even he calling you Lala in that story. Are you Dolores to anyone?
That was a mistake. I was only Dolores to my dad. My whole family called me Lala, except my dad. My dad called me Dolores.
Okay, where did the Lala come from?
It came from my sister. My sister, we were 2 years apart, and I guess she couldn't pronounce Dolores, and you know, that leads to sometimes Lolo, Dololo, or whatever, and it came to be Lala.
Okay.
And ever since that, they called me Lala.
Gotcha. Okay, okay. I was called Debbie by one of my young cousins before he could pronounce anything, so. Well, going back early, I'm going to be touching on early days, Crystals days, and some of your stuff today, so I'll be bouncing around a little bit, but somewhat in order. Let's start with the Little Gospel Tears. Who and what were these for you and the community?
I started when I was 7 in the Gospel Church. And Little Gospel Tears was my brother, my sister, and my niece. And we used to sing every Sunday in the gospel churches. And
wow.
Sometimes we'd go around to other churches and sing. And that day, it was a very famous group called the Clara Ward Singers. And we were the little group that would, she would let us go to the church with her. And we'd be the little children that would sing gospel.
Oh, my gosh. That
yeah.
is so nice. And, you know, yeah. and the thing is, I knew that it was a gospel church group, but I had no idea it was a family event. It was you and some of your siblings. That's really nice.
Yeah, it was some of my siblings, yeah.
And were there 11 of you? Did I read that right?
Yeah, that's 11 of us, but I'm the second generation.
Okay. And were there more of you involved musically, or were you the only one
that
took off?
My older brother, he could sing, and my mom, she had a nice voice, but no one took it seriously. I was the only one that I guess had the voice, you know?
Okay. Well, that was yeah. definitely proved to the world in a big way with the Crystals. And so, again, basic stuff here, but tell me about the name of the group, the Crystals. Was this purely a Phil Spector thing? Did he name you, or did you guys come in with that name?
We came in with the name. There was one of the girls in the group. Her name is Patsy Wright, and she had an older sister. And her older sister had a little girl that was about 3 at the time when we were started, and her name was Crystal. And when the group started, they tried to figure out what name could we have. So they used Patsy Wright's sister's daughter's name.
Oh, nice.
And her name is Crystal.
Okay.
And that's where they got the name from.
Wow, you could have been the Belindas had it gone some other way. Okay. Well, good. I like the Crystals much better. Okay. I understand that the beginning of you with the Crystals, you were discovered in an after-school program by Dee Dee, one of the
yeah.
other original. Tell me about this day, this moment, how this all came down.
It wasn't by Dee Dee, it was Dee Dee's mom. See, before I met Dee Dee and the other girls, I was with Dee Dee's mom, and her friend a person that I used to always see her with was my gym teacher, Mr. Lynch. And in fact, I thought she was married to Mr. Lynch because they were together all the time. But because I was a kid, I don't know the difference.
Sure.
But she worked in the school, like after school programs. So what would happen is that because my mom, she didn't want us to play on the street. So she would give us an option either stay in the house or go back to school and do some kind of recreation, whether it's drawing, learning something else, or revising your studies or whatever. So this particular day I went back, and like I would do every day at 3:00, 3:30, I walked into the school as usual, and I hear this piano, and I followed the piano. I said, "Is this piano playing?" And Mrs. Henry, which is Dee Dee's mom, she was the overseer for the children, us going back to school to make sure we don't fight, to make sure we don't get in trouble. Mm-hmm. If we had any problems, we would go to her and ask her. And when I walked in, she said, "What do you want to play today, Lolly? You going to play volleyball? You going to jump rope? You going to, you know, interact with the kids?" And so when I heard this piano, all I can think of was, I want to find out where that piano is.
Mm.
When she started working with the other children, I just walked down the hallway and I followed the piano sound. And it was a man in there. His name was Leo. And so I just stood at the door and I said, "Could I sing?" And he said, "Can you?" And I said, "Yeah." And I walked in there and I started singing. And then Dee Dee's mom, with the group, Dee Dee Kennebo's mom, heard me. And she came down and she stood in the door and she listened. And she said to me after I finished, she said, "Was that you with that big voice, the little girl with that big voice?" And I said, "Yes." And so she said, "You know, well, would you like to join a Crystals group?" Mm. And I said, "Yeah." Me being silly, I was only 12 and a half.
Yeah.
You know, I'm saying yes, you know, because I knew I could sing. I'm singing gospel. And then I thought about it, and I said, "Well, you have to speak to my mom first." You know, and then she said, "I sure do," because, you know, she was a very beautiful woman. And she knew about children and how, you know, the mothers were very important to ask any questions to. So she came to my house. She asked my mom. My mom was a little bit leery because I was so young. I was like 12 and a half at that time.
Sure.
And my mom questioned her, and then she said, "Well, by Lala being the youngest, we naturally, when we travel on the road, we would have a guardian for her." And they had a guardian for me. Now, the guardian was Patsy Wright's mother was available. She stayed at home, so she took on the road, but she came on the road with us, and she traveled with us. So she was a guardian for me.
So you weren't necessarily this scared little girl out on the road. I mean, there were incidents with the Dick Clark tour, and I'd like to address that a little bit later on, but you had somebody to trust and look up to and to take care of you in those earliest of days.
Yeah, I always had somebody there to make sure I wouldn't do things bad or, you know, everything's not as peaches and cream in show business, but I was always protected. And then after I got into the group, I was going to PS 73, which was a public school. I was taken out of that, and I was put into a private school.
Okay.
And so when I went into private school, I was in a private school with Anthony Quinn's son, Duncan Quinn.
I was
in the school with Patty Duke.
Huh.
I was in school with Bernadette Peters.
Oh, wow.
Dinah Washington's two sons. I was in school with very famous children.
Yes, you were. I have to say, I grew up a jazz nut and proudly a jazz geek these days, so you had me at Dinah Washington.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Lala Brooks, part of the lineup with the Best of Doo-Wop Volume 6 at the Cerritos Center for the Performing Arts in a few weeks, along with Larry Chance from the Earls, Kenny Vance in the Planetones, the Capris, and the a cappella group Classic Sounds. More at larentr.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and mobile devices at kvcrnews.org.
How long were you in the Crystals before "And Then He Kissed Me" and "To Do Ron Ron"? How long was that? Because you were 12, going on 13 when you joined.
Well, I turned 13. That year I turned 13 in the summertime.
Okay.
And then we did our first tour. I was 13. We did our first tour with James Brown. And then Barbara was doing the lead. Phil was recording the Crystals in New York.
Okay.
And Barbara was doing lead. She did "There's Nothing Like My Baby" uptown.
Yeah.
And she did "What a Nice Way to Turn 17.
Yeah.
A lot of few songs Phil just used her on. Eventually, when he found out I could sing, he knew I could sing, but, you know, I was so young, and I was very strong, very powerful. Like, I would sing backgrounds on Barbara's things, but they had to push me in the back because it was so big, so loud. But eventually, I got to do the lead. I was doing the lead on stage most of the time, so that's how I get to be lead singer, too. Barbara, when she sang "There's No Other Like My Baby" in Uptown, when we get to play the Apollo or we'd play shows, Barbara was very shy, but I didn't know it, you know. And she would always ask me when I'd come off stage, and I'm 13, she'd say, "Lala, do you want to do "There's No Other Like My Baby" in Uptown on the next show?" And I said, "Yeah." You know, I was like the young ham, you know, teenager.
Sure. Yeah.
So I did that, and from that day on, she didn't want to do the lead, so I would do the lead. Every performance we did at the Apollo, I was doing the lead.
This had to have been sort of a confusing mix for you of, am I embarking on a professional career or am I just having a blast as a kid?
I think I just was having a blast as a kid because I wasn't, I was so young to key into about fame and being pompous and
right.
a diva. I didn't grow up like that. I didn't grow up like, my mom was very grounded, and she made sure I was grounded. So I never, even to today, I never had that diva kind of things. In fact, the fans, even when fans come up to me and they're excited, I'm like, huh? And I'm so much normal, and I love the fans because, in fact, I hate to even say they're fans because it sounds so much, I'm so humble, you know, I'm just so
right.
grateful to them, and sometimes I'm embarrassed to say they're fans, you know.
It puts a separation between you and them by using that
word. I don't like that, you know.
Yeah.
But I love them, and they love me. In fact, some of the fans that I write to on Facebook, I've been out to their house. I've been to the movies with them. I've been to Coney Island with them. I go to their house and I eat dinner.
And they're just people wandering around the village for you, just people that you could run into at the market.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And a lot of them, when they become fans, they become friends.
Nice.
You know, and I'm friendly with one girlfriend of mine. I was walking down the street, Paula, and she was staring at me. She kind of scared me, you know. She kept staring and staring. And I was walking to the store, and she was coming up to me, and I said, oh, my God, what is this about? But she was too afraid to say anything.
Mm.
And finally, when I turned around, I said, do you have anything to say? Or do you... I whatever I said to her was like startled because I was kind of like nervous.
Yeah.
And then she says, oh, my God, are you Lala Brooks? And I said, yes, I am. She said, I saw you at Lincoln Center, Darlene Love, and somebody else. And she said, she was so sweet. And I was saying, oh, thank you. And she's my best friend now. We go to the movie.
Oh, cool. Oh, nice. Nice.
Anytime I need a movie partner, I call. I said, Paul, you want to go see this movie? She said, yeah. And after we go to the movie, we go have tea and coffee, and then we have something to eat. She's my best friend.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Some of the big hits that I mentioned earlier, I mean, you mentioned Uptown and There's No Other and those ones, but the ones that I suppose that you were most involved with and people will look back the most often on are And Then He Kissed Me and Do-Do Ron Ron, of course. And Then He Kissed Me, did you end up later getting royalties or anything like that? You know, because And Then He Kissed Me was so big in movies much later on, Adventures in Babysitting and Goodfellas. Do you have any back end, I guess? Is that the word for that?
Well, they called me just now, not too long ago. But I had been getting royalties from another source, from other records, you know, from the Crystals, maybe a Christmas album. Just general royalties.
Okay.
You know, from probably airplay or something like that. But I just got a call from other people now. Maybe I'll get some royalties from that. But, you know, Phil had locked everything up at one point. Everything was going to Phil Spector, you know.
Okay.
And sometimes when you lock up movies and you don't give, it's just a technical kind of thing for producers to just, you know, find a way to, you know, discredit or to hurt the artists that recorded the records and they keep all the money themselves, you know.
It's always something that, you know, I've spoken with artists today. Mark Volman from the Turtles comes to mind. He actually advises people nowadays, young groups trying to get into a contract, and he tries to advise them in getting the best kind of contract. That's so unfortunate. You hear about that kind of thing so much that people were so huge but got a few dimes out of it, figuratively,
yeah,
I suppose.
But, horrible, you know. But then again, you know, when you think about it, I try to put in a positive thing because if you don't, you get mad and want to go there and strangle somebody.
Yeah, that's true.
But you put it in a perspective where, you know, you can't take it with you. You're just going in a box with yourself and your soul and your one suit, you know, all that other stuff is going to stay here. Nothing really belongs to us. We leave it here for somebody else continuously. So if Phil Spector ever thinks that he's going in a box or anybody with the millions that he stole from me, he's going with a record that says he stole from young teenagers.
Oh,
you know?
Wow.
So that's recorded. So I would rather not have the money. You know, it's like you reap what you sow, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
And for me to, I mean, I had good days with Phil. I can't say I hate Phil or dislike him or, but I don't care who it is, you know, whether it's Phil, whether it's my brother, whether it's my sister. When you take from somebody that's so young and you want everything for yourself, karma comes back to you.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And I think that's what happened with Phil Spector, even though I love him in my way because I was a teenager. And I still would love to meet him again and say, you know, I forgive you, but karma comes back, you know, but comes back in a different way. It doesn't come back from what you did to me, you know, because that's recorded already, but it'll be set up where you do something to someone else that is not in the business, and you have to pay for that.
I mean,
I was only 13 years old, and we didn't come from a lot of money. We were a humble family. We didn't have anything. I mean, my dad worked a 9-to-5 job. My mother stayed at home. We were just typical family. And then we were very famous, and the name is famous. And we worked hard. You know, we worked. I worked since I was 13. I never asked my mother for a pair of shoes. You know, I bought everything myself. You know, she would have given it to me naturally. But why ask my mom when she's just, her dad has just had a regular job, not a lot of money? I pay for myself. So I paid for everything I bought when I was 13, from the time I was 13. And you mean to tell me Phil Spector's a grown man and he tried to shortchange all of us? For what?
It keeps on stacking up and it means nothing after a while.
Yeah, and now where can you use it? He's in prison. Where can you use the money now? You're locked up.
Yeah, nobody has it. Oh, my gosh.
You know, it's sad. It's so sad. And if he would have done the right thing, maybe in the stars or in the skies, you would have been protected in some way. But when you do ruthless things, you have to just wait for the karma to come.
Yeah, there it is once again. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Back now to Lala Brooks, part of the lineup with the Best of Doo-Wop Volume 6 at the Cerritos Center for the Performing Arts. More at larentr.com. Lala, one of your other huge, huge hits with the Crystals, To Do Ron Ron. Now, I'm at the perfect age to have known Sean Cassidy coming out with that song. Now, what I have to say is he waited until he was 19 to come out with this. By your standards, isn't 19 a little old for this, don't you think?
I guess old for the year of lyrics. It is kind of old for the lyrics, especially a guy.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, if he took it from somebody, there's a big difference.
Yeah.
He copied. So when you copy something from somebody, it's really not genuinely yours. So he just copied it. It'd be different if he was 19 and he started singing a song when he was 19. Say, whoa, where are you going with this one?
Yeah.
But because he took it from me as a teenager, I can let him off the hook a little bit and say, okay, it's all right.
He's just another kid. It was a young mistake.
Okay, just another kid, yeah.
Did you hear To Do Ron Ron on the radio, or did you know that this brother of David Cassidy was about to bring this song out?
Yeah, I know. I heard about it, yeah.
And then the same thing, was that the same thing with And Then He Kissed Me, as far as it being used in these movies? It's in one of the most famous scenes of Goodfellas, this long, long entrance.
I know, when they sit at the table.
Yes.
I know the scene so well.
Oh, yeah.
Because many a day I watched that movie and said, damn it, I wish I had the money that they are playing this movie over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So with you being so young when you joined the Crystals, you couldn't have been very old when they broke up. How old were you at this point?
No, I was like my 20s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So
I got married, and then I went to Broadway. when I left the group, I went to Broadway. I was an original cast in Hair with Diane Keaton, Melba Moore, Keith Carradine, Ronnie Dyson. I did Aquarius in Hair.
Yes, I'm excited about it because I'm a theater geek as well. And so when I saw that, oh my gosh. But you didn't end up on the soundtrack. That was a different recording.
Yeah, the soundtrack, well, my husband did a soundtrack and played the drums for everything.
Idris Muhammad?
Idris Muhammad, yeah.
Oh, wow.
He played off-Broadway, and then it went to Broadway. So he did everything with Hair, even when it wasn't on Broadway. He played all the music. He made everything for the Hair. He made all the drum sounds, drum beats, and everything.
Wow. Now, that's another wonderful connection that I know about him as, like, you know, basically one of the sidemen with Pharoah Saunders or, you know, some of these folks from way back when in my jazz library, but I had no idea that he was such an integral part of Hair. That
oh, yes. If it wasn't for him, there wouldn't be a Hair, I don't think, because the only thing he didn't do was copyright the drum beat. Every drum beat in Hair belonged to him. And we used to panic when I started Hair. We used to panic when he'd have to take one day off because sometimes he'd have a record date with, you know, Coltrane,
right.
one of jazz musicians, yeah. Dizzy Gillespie, because he was a jazz musician. Well, he was a rock and roll player because he did all of Sam Cooke's things and he did a lot of Fats Domino's things, too.
Hmm. Didn't know that a part of it.
Played the drums, he did a lot. Oh, my God. Nat Adderley, Fats Domino, Roberta Flack.
Oh, my God.
He did a lot of Keep On Pushing. He did all of Curtis Mayfield's sound, too. From the back of the day, he did all the drum beats for that.
Wow.
So when he'd get out of Hair and say that he had a record date, we'd be running around and saying, oh, my God, he's not here. What are we going to do? Because he'd give us the cue for every beat. He was a genius. He really was with the drums. The only thing he didn't, copyright the drum beats. He went to go to do it, but they got into some kind of, you know, sharing thing, and I think my husband got kind of like, why share when it belongs to me, you know, that kind of technical stuff, and next thing you know, it never was done. But he made Hair what it was. And then when I got in it, I did Aquarius.
Okay, oh my gosh. Is there a recording of that out there anywhere? I've already looked, and I can't find one. Is there you singing Aquarius?
No, I did it on Ed Sullivan, if they ever played that. On YouTube, I'm not doing Aquarius, but I'm on the Tony Awards, up on the top of the thing with Melba Moore, and we're doing What a Piece of Work Is Man.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's another one of the strongest.
And Harry Belafonte introduces us when we were doing Tony Awards. So you could pull that up with Harry Belafonte in Hair, and then you'll hear him speak, and then we'll sing a little bit of Walking in Space, and the original cast is on the Tony Awards. Then you'll see me up at the top of 22. I'm singing What a Piece of Work Is Man with Melba.
Oh, fantastic. That'll be playing in the background as we speak about this then. Getting away from music then, but still on Broadway, is this true you also did Two Gentlemen of Verona? And if so, which character were you?
Well, I did one of the main singers. It was only four singers, and I was the main singer, the main character singer in the play. They wanted me to do the principal, understudy the principal, which was
Sylvia?
Sylvia.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. Lord have mercy, I couldn't do it.
Hmm.
That's what they picked me for. They picked me for the voice, and they picked me because they made us look alike.
Same
kind of body, same kind of face, you know.
Gotcha.
You know how they do that. They pick, when you go for auditions, they sort of have in mind, oh, she can do this, she can do chorus, but she can also do the principal. When they came for me for the principal, I said, no, I didn't want to do it, the understudy, because I didn't like the scene where they go into a tent, and Sylvia lays on the ground, on the tent, and the guy gets on top of her.
Oh,
I was turned away from that.
Yeah.
My wasn't raised like that, you know.
Yeah.
And so then the girls in the play started fighting over the part. Mm. And I let them fight over the part because I didn't want to have anything to do with it. Singing, yes. Or a little bit of skit acting, yes, I can do that. But I can't do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I just couldn't do it. And when I'd hear her in the tent screaming and yelling and she's on top of it, I just couldn't do it. And so I said, no money in the world.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Wow.
My morals were different.
Yes.
You know, and I was raised different. You know, I was raised, my mothers were very protective. I was protected on the road. I was very, you know, classy. I go crazy on stage, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
That's just acting.
Yeah.
You know, that's just a part of happiness. But in order to go into a tent on that play, it just was too awkward for me. I couldn't do it.
Wow.
So they were upset because I realized they hired me for the voice and to do the chorus. They also hired me to do the principal to understudy this girl named Alan. I forgot her name. It's Sylvia, but I was too shy and embarrassed to do it.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Lala Brooks, part of the lineup with the Best of Doo-Wop Volume 6 at the Cerritos Center for the Performing Arts in just a few weeks, along with Larry Chance from the Earls, Kenny Vance and the Planetones, the Capris, as well as the a cappella group Classic Sounds. More at LAR Enterprises, that's LARENTR.com. I need to jump up to some of today's stuff, but really quickly, I know that you also contributed songs to movie soundtracks. My wife is an academic, and she teaches various blaxploitation and Asian cinema and Hispanic or Latino cinema. And so I've actually seen and rather enjoyed Cotton Comes to Harlem, okay? What did you contribute to that? Or is that, did I misread that?
No, me and Melvin Moore mm-hmm. and Vita Galloway, we did all the soundtrack. I did We're Going Home, when you're running through the street, I recorded that, We're Going Home, it's called. Great song, great yeah. gospel song. I did all the background, then I did another song with Vita Galloway. She did one part and I did one part. But as far as the whole sound, me, Melba, and Vita Galloway did the whole score of Cotton from the Harlem, and we were also in it.
I'm going to have to look again then.
Part.
Okay,
the
cool.
thing is, and Calvin Lockhart, he comes on stage and he pushes us. Melba's there and Vita Galloway. So we're in the movie too. I was about 22 then.
There's a light, a certain kind of light that never shines on me. And I want my life to be live with you, baby, live with you. There's a way, everybody said, to do each and everything. Does it do if I ain't got you, baby? Ain't got you. You don't know what it's like, baby. You don't know what it's like to love somebody, to love somebody the way I love you.
All or Nothing. When was this released? This was just a couple of years ago, maybe?
I think 2013, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, okay. Well, I know To Love Somebody as a Bee Gees tune.
Yeah.
And I have no liner notes in front of me. So I have to just ask you then, did you write any of these tunes? Did you go picking tunes that you wanted to present? Or was this a manager? How did this album come together, please?
Well, Norton Records, they always wanted to record me, and they made me an offer, and I said, okay, you know. The only thing I didn't like is the music part, the background. I think they should have had better musicians. But I only wrote one song on there, and I wrote You Gave Me Love. I wrote the lyrics and the music for that. And it could have done well if they would have had better musicians. There was only like two people there doing it. What can I tell you? It's something that could have been so great to do.
Wow.
I mean, to sell, you know what I'm saying? But
yes.
If you want to do it on a cheap dime, I think they just wanted the name. That's what I think.
On the cover, it doesn't even say Lala Brooks. It says Lala Brooks of the Crystals. They're cashing in on something from a long time ago.
Right, so I think it was more so about the company.
Well, there's the
I mean,
part.
I got paid for it, but you still wait for royalties from them, you know. I like the album, but I just wish they would have spent more time on bringing musicians in instead of using two people and somebody's wife to tap on something.
Oh, my
gosh. You know, that's what happened.
It's a solid album, I think, but I think the next time I listen to it, I may be hearing it with a different ear. It's such a presentation of soul and rock and roll, some R&B. So, again, were you looking for this variety, or this is what was presented and what you pared it down to?
Well, you know, if you want to be truthful, whoever they put down there, I think Nick or somebody else has producers, I produced that album. I showed them what to do. I put that R&B. I put everything there that I wanted for them to do. That's why they would have had great musicians there and musicians in the studio.
Gotcha.
I did that record like in a cellar, you know, and then sometimes the mic was falling off like wickety-wackety-whack. I couldn't go into the studio part because there was so much dust and dirt. I'm like, okay, where's this going, you know?
Oh, wow.
And I helped produce that. I helped put it together. No, don't do this. They sent me some stuff, that I think Nick, whatever his name is, he was playing so loud and so I said, okay, this company is for rock and roll. They want that hard rock, that crazy rock. So they're covering up my voice. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I said, no. You're going to take that down. We're going to push this up. We're going to put it like this. And I practically produced that album.
Forget how you look tonight. Never mind your.
When you're performing a doo-wop era concert, do you break out anything from All or Nothing, or do you keep it with, of course, To Do Run Run, and Then He Kissed Me? There's...
Well, I have to, because doo-wop is not familiar with that kind of music.
How About a Boy Like You? That has a slight feel of It Could Go Back.
Yeah, I've done that. I like that. I've done A Boy Like You. I love that song. But when I do it on stage with my own show, I can do it. But sometimes with doo-wops, they're not familiar. You have to do songs you're familiar with.
Of course.
And a lot of the producers, the promoters, want to hear those familiar doo-wop songs that people know.
Oh, naturally, yeah, yeah.
You know, so that's a natural thing. But I've done that on stage. I've done some of the album, a lot of the songs I did in Spain, and when I have my own show here, I do them, you know.
What are some of the other staples, then, of live performances with doo-wop shows beyond, you know, the top 10 hits? Do you break out other hits from other artists? You know, you're wanting to make the audience feel good. What else do you bring out besides the crystals?
I've done Be My Baby, Going to the Chapel of Love, We Used to Love Me Tomorrow with the Shirelles.
Mm.
I've done Baby Love.
Oh, wow, nice.
I go from one to another, but it's like a medley, acknowledging them, you know.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Music in Conversation with Lala Brooks, with and without the crystals, to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Once again, Brooks is part of the lineup with the Best of Doo-Wop Volume 6 at the Cerrito Center for the Performing Arts in a few weeks, along with Larry Chance from the Earls, Kenny Vance and the Planetones, the Capris, as well as the a cappella group Classic Sounds. That's presented by LAR Enterprises. More at LARENTR.com. Thanks again to Emmanuel Rogers and his conversation with author Mark Bowden. Also, thanks to Lala Brooks, as well as to Nathan Gothels of Affordable Music Productions for originally getting me in touch with Lala. It should be noted that the concert with Brooks is through LAR Enterprises. The next Affordable Music Productions concert will be the first week of June. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and NPR One. And all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.